This is Patient Care Theory 2, Unit 7, Part 1, Pediatric Airways. Thank you. Pediatric Airways. So, you'll hear this saying a lot. Children are not little adults. In some ways, they're adults, like adults. But anatomically and physiologically, they're a little bit different from adults. We'll talk about that. So the airway, for example, because of their anatomy, they have an increased risk of airway obstruction, even from just swelling of the airway. We'll talk about that. So there's a formula. It says resistance to airflow is inversely proportional to the fourth power of the radius of the airway. Now, don't memorize that, because I'm not going to test you on that formula, but what that means essentially is that a millimeter of concentric edema in a newborn trachea, and the trachea radius of the trachea is only about 2 millimeters, increases resistance 16-fold. Right, we don't see that kind of change in resistance in adults, but in newborns, infants, smaller children, a little bit of airway edema can be very, very serious. Their head is proportionally larger. And you guys don't mind, I'm gonna sit, because it's Friday, and I'm tired. What? You agree, you okay with it? The head's relatively larger. Bueller. And it's somewhat naturally flexed, and this becomes a bit of a problem. So they have this proportionally larger head, they have a shorter neck, they have a small mandible, they have a large posteriorly placed tongue, and we know that the tongue is the most common cause of airway obstruction in all ages, but that becomes even more of a problem with kids. And they have a cone-shaped trachea. So in adults, you'll remember that the narrowest part of the airway is at the glottic opening, the glottis. In kids, the narrowest part of the airway is below the glottis at the cricoid ring. So they have a funnel-shaped airway, which is a bit of a problem, and can present with a problem. I don't know, this. Every time I look at this kid's picture, I feel like this kid looks older than his size and was instructed to lay like that and said, sure, no problem. How long do you want me to lay like this for? I don't know. There's something about this kid. He just looks older and wiser than his size would suggest. I don't know why. Don't you think? Either that or he's dead and they just put him in that position. What's that? The double chin, maybe. What's that expression? If you feel bad about your weight, keep your chins up. Just all four or five of mine. So disturbing. So a couple of problems with a kid's their head, their neck, their whole anatomy in that area is that their trachea rings are not fully formed. They're very pliable. So a couple things. One, because their occiput is fairly large, their head is, if they're laying supine, they're typically already in a flexed position, which means they're, because their airway is pliable, it's their airway gets kinked, it collapses on itself. And two, it really means all we need to do is extend the head. So to get a kid in, to get an adult in a sniffing position, you flex the neck, extend the head, right? So the kid, because the neck is already flexed because of the large occiput, we just extend the head. And sometimes we have to put a little towel underneath the shoulders to help with that. So with kids, if the airway is overextended, the trachea collapses, kinks off. If the neck is too flexed, then the airway collapses and kinks off and the tongue obstructs the airway. So we got to get that kid just in the right position. And generally, think about the earlobes in alignment with the manubrium, with the sternal notch right here. That's the way it should be. So young kids, especially in the 12 to 24 month of age, have this propensity to aspirate foreign bodies. In my entire life, I've never seen and only heard of one kid who aspirated and choked on a hot dog. You know, if you ask any parent or any adult, you know, what do kids choke on, most of them will tell you hot dogs or candies. They would be wrong on the hot dog front, but not far off on the candy front. And certainly, because most parents cut up the hot dogs into several pieces. But candies for sure, coins especially. Most airway obstructions I've been called to, it's been a coin, like a penny or a dime or something. You won't see pennies anymore because they don't exist. Apparently the paper dollar is worth like $7,000 now, eh? Yeah, what's that? Yeah, I have a few of those too at home. Yeah. If anyone knows how to sell them, I'll give you mine. I'll share a little bit of the profit with you. So when it comes to maneuvers, we follow the Heart and Stroke Foundation guidelines. But airway obstruction and cardiac arrest, we just follow the advanced directive. So I'll just let you go over that on your own. But basically, we do CPR in a single shock and transport. I won't go over the details of that. Now, croup in kids, also referred to as laryngotracheal bronchitis. Affects the subglottic tissue. Right? This is a test question. Supraglottic or subglottic tissue? So it affects the subglottic tissue. So just below the vocal cords, right? Just remember that. And croup happens as a result of a viral infection and will present with varying degrees of airway obstruction. Most common in 3 months to 3 years. Uncommon in children over six, but I've seen it in kids over six. Kids over six, we don't worry too much about their airways because their airways are larger, but it's those young kids who have those tiny airways, and remember, a little bit of swelling can cause a significant resistance in those kids. And if you stress those kids out by coming in, you know, and loudly saying, "Hey kid, how's it going? How you doing there?" You know, you're gonna put them into a full airway obstruction. Yeah.
Is it impossible for an adult to get croup, or is it something that can happen?
I've never heard of an adult with croup,
okay.
But you never know. You can get whooping cough as an adult, if you're unvaccinated. And we see adults with, rarely, but the only two cases of epiglottitis I've ever seen in my life have both been in adults. We used to see epiglottitis in kids in the 50s. Not me. I'm not from the 50s, but it wasn't uncommon to see epiglottitis in kids, but now it's when it does happen, which is rare in adults. But croup, no, I've never heard of croup, and not even in teens. But there are colds that'll sound a little croupy because they're barking cough, and that's one of the classic presentations for croup. So history, typically they have an upper respiratory tract infection with a low fever, runny nose, and mild cough. So typically cold-like symptoms, right? Kids always feel sicker in the evening, you know, when they're quiet, they're not distracted, they're not playing with their iPad or watching TV, and they develop stridor and a barking cough, and oftentimes wake up, at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night in distress, and they're anxious, they're upset. They're, you know, obviously more comfortable sitting up. And on exam findings, so typically there'll be either barking cough or a history of barking cough, like a seal-like cough that progresses to loud stridor. And whenever I've had croupy kids, you can hear the stridor without even auscultating the chest. Typically low-grade fever, slower onset, 24 to 72 hours following upper respiratory infection. And I only put drooling in there because drooling, you see excessive drooling with epiglottitis. And so that's sort of the one of the distinctive features. There may be accessory muscle use. The only time when you would intervene with maybe PPV is if they've got three-word dyspnea and altered mental status. You know, if the kid's kind of like this. If they're like that, that's a bad sign. So you have to make a decision, do we PPV this kid or not? Let me talk about the treatments in just a second. So when you auscultate the chest, and these kids may be crying, and mom's going to be holding the kid, and I would leave the kid in mom's arms. No reason why you can't auscultate the kid while they're crying, because everyone takes deep breaths when they cry, right? And it may be a pallor. Cyanosis would be a bit of a concern. So as I mentioned, we want to interfere with the kid as little as possible, keep him with mom. We have to establish a rapport with mom and establish a rapport with the baby, if we can, and get the baby's trust or the child's trust, and maybe let mom hold the stethoscope, hold the nebulizer mask, things like that. If they need oxygen, we can give blow-by oxygen. If they're not in much distress at all, we just have mom carry the kid out to the ambulance and expose the kid to cold air. But nebulized epi is like a miracle cure. It's quite remarkable. You get a kid who's in a lot of distress, and you get a nebulizer mask close to them. Typically, we give 5 milligrams of nebulized epi. That's a lot of epinephrine. That means breaking open 5 nebules and or 5 ampules, drawing it up, drawing up the next one, drawing up the next one until you got 5, putting it into the chamber here, and then aerosolizing it. If wherever possible, I would rather initiate nebulized epinephrine than go to PPV. The trouble with PPV is you can't get nebulized epinephrine into them at that point. And the one thing that's going to really open up their airway is going to be nebulized epinephrine and transport. So let me that's what an ampule of epinephrine looks like. And you've got to drop 5 of those. So it's a little bit time consuming. Okay. For age criteria, rarely are you going to get, first of all, a croupy kid under 5 kilos and under a year of age. Under a year isn't unusual, but under 5 kilos, we're talking about neonates. You know, maybe a month old, 2 months old max, who's a small child. And so it's a small dose. You give 0.5 milligrams, and you'd have to add about another couple of cc's of saline to that. If they're less than a year and over 5 kilos, which is more typical, then they get 2.5 milligrams of epinephrine, and you might add another 1 cc or 1.5 cc's of normal saline with that. And if they're over a year and up to the age of 8, they get 5 milligrams. So the vast majority of croupy kids that you encounter, you're going to be giving 5 milligrams nebulized, and you're going to give it one time. And that kid will go from being very distressed in the back of the ambulance, they'll be breathing perfectly normally. And typically after a stressful event like that, the kids will fall asleep. That's been my experience. When kids are stressed out, it exhausts them, right? And so if they fall asleep in the back of the ambulance, my only concern is monitoring their SpO2, making sure their chest is moving and they're exchanging air, that their oxygen saturation is good, and giving them oxygen if they need it. But most kids don't need it after nebulized epi. And I just let them rest. Because the minute you get to the hospital, you open the back door of the ambulance, they're going to wake up crying or upset, most likely anyway. So I just leave them and monitor them. Okay. So epiglottitis, in contrast, involves the supraglottic structure. So remember, croup is subglottic. Right? Croup is subglottic. Epiglottitis is supraglottic. Epiglottitis is very rare. Might be seen in older children, 2 to 7 years, but more likely to be seen in adults now, unvaccinated adults. It typically has a much more rapid onset, a much more sudden sudden onset of fever as opposed to a slower onset with croup, shortness of breath, stridor retraction, cyanosis. The really distinctive features are the drooling and this really pronounced sniffing position. So, you know, when we talk about people tripoding when they're short of breath, everybody tripods, right? Everyone sits sort of forward and might tripod when they're short of breath. But with epiglottitis, because there's a swollen epiglottis and it's partially obstructing the airway, they stick their neck way out to try to get that epiglottis off of their trachea. And so they're in a really pronounced sniffing position, and they drool a lot. The drool is just coming out of their mouth. And so that would be distinctive from croup. Now, if you had a child who presented like that and you couldn't make the distinction between whether this is an epiglottitis or croup, and they were stridorous,
you probably treat it the same way, and no one would criticize you for doing that. Is epi going to be helpful in a epiglottitis? Honestly, I'm not sure if it would be or not. But epiglottitis is a life-threatening airway emergency, and these kids typically have to be intubated, and an advanced care paramedic is probably not going to intubate this kid. Even an ER doc is probably not going to want to intubate this kid. It scares the crap out of them. Even the anesthesiologists, who are the experts, they're the ones who are going to have to intubate them, but it'll scare the crap out of anesthesiologists as well. And they use a fiber optic scope to intubate them. So they use a scope that has a camera on the tip of it that looks down at the trachea, because you wouldn't want to mess with an airway like that. It's with croup, it's rare that you'd ever have to intubate. Management with nebulized epinephrine is usually good. So with epiglottitis, we avoid, well, croup or epiglottitis, any sort of airway issue, unless it's a foreign body that we need to remove. We avoid distressing the child. We don't look in the airway. We don't take a flashlight. We don't ask them to stick out their tongue. We don't do anything with the airway. We keep the child with the parent. If we need to give them oxygen, then we give oxygen to the parent, ask them to hold it by. If I'm giving nebulized epinephrine, I'll usually give mom, I'll put a surgical mask on her just to keep her from inhaling that nebulized epinephrine. It's not going to hurt her, so it's not the end of the world if you don't do that, but there's no reason why she needs to get a cardiovascular workout from inhaling that epi. And those kids have all got to go to the hospital, right? So even though the kid might look normal and feel normal after they've gotten nebulized epi, I can't imagine any parent saying, oh, he's good now, I'll just take him back in the house. I can't imagine that ever happening. But if they did, that kid who's getting epi has to be monitored for at least 4 to 6 hours, right? Because it's a very potent sympathomimetic. So the whole croup versus epiglottitis, the key things are, the key distinctions are this really, really pronounced sniffing position in epiglottitis and the drooling in epiglottitis. And the other stuff is just sort of here and there. Management, largely supportive care. Keep the child with the parents. Nebulized epinephrine is like a miracle. I remember when we first got nebulized epinephrine and started treating croup with it, it's on par with epinephrine with anaphylaxis and dextrose and water with unconscious diabetics. The reversal of symptoms happens within 2 to 5 minutes, and it's quite dramatic. It's really it's a satisfying call. It's like, and the parents are so grateful. It's like, oh my God, you saved my child's life. And I'm not going to say no. You know, I'm not sure that I really saved the child's life, but I'm not going to dispel any myths they might have developed about us. You know, paramedics don't get enough recognition, so I'm just going to humbly say thank you. You know, my pleasure. So PPD rarely required. If you're going to how do you know they're going to need PPV? Who needs positive pressure ventilation? What's your two critical criteria? Well, apneic, yes, for sure. Yeah, apneic. Three-word dyspnea. Altered mental status, yeah. Apneic for sure, though. Oh, they're apneic, but they don't have three-word dyspnea. But they'll definitely, if they don't have altered mental status, they will soon. But apnea, yes, for sure. That's definitely the obvious one. Okay. How do you know when ventilation and oxygenation is effective in a kid who's in distress? What changes are you looking for? Matt? Yeah, skin color improves, right? Maybe cyanosis disappears. That'd be great. Yeah. Jake? SATs will go up, yeah, for sure. Yeah, respirations might decrease. What about heart rate? Any kid in respiratory stress, Melanie? Decreases, what is that? Yeah, but decreases, yeah. Sorry, I just couldn't hear you. Yeah, decreases, yeah, exactly. So they're tachycardic to compensate for the hypoxia, and heart rate comes down with oxygenation, ventilation. That's a good thing. Yeah. unless they were bradycardic, which is a very ominous sign with hypoxia. Bradycardia is kind of a last stage before you die with hypoxia. Then you'd want to see the heart rate come up. But typically, hypoxic kids are tachycardic, and you'll see the heart rate come down once they get oxygenated. Good. Anything else? Yeah, mental status improves.
Less distress.
Less distress.
Better end title.
Better end title. And maybe having a TIA here. I'm trying to remember. Yeah, all those things. Good. So chest wall rises, no energy in the stomach, color improves, LOA improves, heart rate comes down, or back up to normal, SpO2 improves, ECG rhythm, good. Do you want another 3-minute bio break?
Yeah, now we're actually needed.
Okay, no problem.